Hey everyone, this is Patrick Barney, one of the hosts of the Book Spider podcast, a program that covers literature, philosophy, and more recently, fears of a technologically rabid future. With me are co-hosts Chris Malmberg and Haywood Jablomi, my boon companions on a shared intellectual journey towards being a nothingness. This episode, we're going to discuss Mother Night, a novella or novelette by the famed and possibly overrated Kurt Vonnegut. Mother Night tells the story of Howard Campbell Jr., a man born in the United States in the year 1912, but who moves to Germany with his family when he is 11 years old. He grows up to be a successful German playwright, married to a successful German actress. In 1938, he is approached by an American operative and tasked with using his status as a playwright to become a Nazi radio propagandist. As he spews hate speech and invectives over the airwaves, Campbell will also be communicating secret messages for the Allies that will enable them to win the coming war. Campbell decides to go along with this plan because of his innate sense of heroism. He will receive no monetary reward or respect. He will be disavowed if he is ever captured by German forces, though the operative, Frank Wirtanen, does say that if he is ever captured by American forces, strings will be pulled so that he will be released without a trial. Campbell makes it through the war in one piece, though his wife Helga disappears from the front during a morale mission. He visits his father-in-law's house one last time before he decides to escape Germany altogether. There he meets Racy, Helga's little sister, who expresses her enduring love for him, though she is only 12 years old. 15 years later, which is 1961 in the United States, Campbell is living in a rundown apartment building trying to live on the down low since he is wanted for war crimes by the state of Israel. He befriends his downstairs neighbor, Kraft, over a game of chess, but when he receives a letter in the mail from an American soldier hellbent on tracking him down, he knows that things are going to go very bad for him very soon. He learns that his whereabouts and identity have been made public by the Reverend Dr. Jones, the owner of a white supremacist publication that lionizes Campbell. Shortly afterward, Reverend Dr. Jones, along with a retinue of strange characters, including Robert Sterling Wilson, the Black Fur of Harlem, visits Campbell, bringing with them Campbell's long-lost wife, Helga. After a night of lovemaking, Helga admits that she is not, in fact, Helga at all, but Racy, which explains why she doesn't appear to have aged beyond her late 20s. Still, Campbell is intoxicated and vows to love her as he loved Helga. They still have worries, though. Since the FBI and others who want Campbell brought to justice are on his tail, Campbell, Racy, Kraft, Jones, and the others seek refuge in a hideout. When Campbell is alone, he is approached by Wirtanen, who says that he is about to be arrested by the FBI and that Kraft and Racy are actually Soviet agents bent on capturing him and bringing him to Moscow as a fascist criminal. Campbell approaches Kraft and Racy with this information, and they admit to betraying him, though Racy still professes undying love for him. Then, the FBI do break into their hideout, and everyone is arrested except for Racy, who kills herself with a cyanide pill, refusing to live without her heroic vision of love. Kraft is deported, and everyone else but Campbell is sent to prison. Campbell is released without trial, as Wirtanen had promised many years ago. Campbell returns to his ratty apartment, but his zest for life, now that Racy and his strange friends are gone, disappears. The American soldier who sent him the initial threatening letter tracks him down for a confrontation, but Campbell breaks the man's arm with a pipe and tells him to go away. Finally, Campbell knocks on the door of another neighbor, a Jewish doctor, and his mother, both of whom survived Auschwitz, though the doctor was young and remembers very little. Campbell asks them to contact someone so that he can be taken to trial in Israel, which the mother happily does. The final moments of the novel see Campbell in a jail cell writing his memoir, awaiting trial for war crimes. His lawyer has said that if he can produce any evidence that he was an American operative, he will be exonerated. As if by a miracle, Campbell receives a letter from Wartannen offering Wartannen's address, real name, and contact information, as well as a promise to testify in Campbell's defense. However, rather than reveal this to his lawyer, Campbell decides to hang himself, which is the last thing he writes in his memoir. So that's the kind of the overview of the novel. And I wanted to, basically I wanted to start with something that you said, Haywood, last time we talked. You said that, you know, you feel like Vonnegut is overrated. You know, you're not a huge fan, but that you're going to try to keep an open mind. So what do you think? You think this is an example of, you know, normal Vonnegut being crappy, better than normal, worse than normal, somewhere in between? And Chris, obviously chime in as well whenever you feel like it.
How come I didn't get a funny nickname? You not care about me?
No, I care about you, but this is, I just assumed that Hans changed his name to Hey Would You Blow Me because he sent me a CD in the mail. But the return address.
I'm sorry, Hans. I've been misaddressing you.
Yeah, I was worried, actually. Patrick, maybe you can speak, actually, to how much of a legitimate fear this was. I was worried when I mailed that CD that the postal clerk would look at it and go, well, this is, you know, you can't send this pornographic spam through the U.S. mail, and it would just get thrown in the trash. But probably they get too many things to filter out everything with a dumb joke name and their return address.
Yeah, they don't. The clerks, you know, they don't really. I mean, yeah. Well, if
I guess if like
if it's something,
if the return address was like, "Fuck you, suck my dick," right? Like that might be an issue. But I guess the joke, "Hey, would you blow me?" was apparently subtle enough to evade the notice of America's bureaucrats.
Right.
Do you deliver your own mail, Patrick?
I don't. House is not on any of the routes that I do, though I do know my mailman. And one time when my mailman was off, I had to deliver my own mail because I was given a portion of his route and it was the one with my house on it. So
I've heard that postal employees really look down on delivering your own mail. Like it's referred to as wanking. Mail wanking?
that is not true.
Yeah.
That doesn't even make sense. We typically like to have the route that our house is on so that we can take our lunch break at our house.
Yeah. So that if your wife is cheating on you and she's using the mail to communicate with a paramour, you are a step ahead.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Although the managers are like, you're not allowed to do that. We don't care. Fuck the supervisors. Screw them all.
Right. How
this
do I feel
horrible
about
administration that's trying to undo my livelihood. Fuck them as well. Anyway, go on.
How do I feel about Kurt Vonnegut and Mother Night?
Yeah.
I mean, I can't speak to how it fits in the whole kind of larger oeuvre of Kurt Vonnegut, because the only thing of his I've read recently enough to have a really kind of decent critical sense of it is probably Slaughterhouse-Five. I have read Breakfast of Champions and Cat's Cradle, but those were when I was a teenager. So I don't really feel qualified to speak to his kind of whole body of work. How did I feel about Mother Night? Did it soothe my sense that he was overrated? You know, not necessarily. I mean, there were things that I admired about it. There were things I liked about it. There were things that I found a bit irksome about it, or maybe just, I don't know how this book is regarded, right? I don't know if, you know, like people who idolize Vonnegut, I don't know if this book is one of the reasons that they idolize Vonnegut. But there are certain things that do bug me about Vonnegut and certain things that strike me as missed opportunities. I mean, to the basic question of like what's good about this novel, right? I mean, it is a very compelling story. It's a thematically interesting story. He says in the introduction that the theme is, you know, that you become what you pretend to become. And that's an interesting idea that I think, you know, the text bears out. There's some interesting twists and turns. I'd forgotten until I started reading it, but I saw the movie. There was a movie version of this in 1996. Right. And I had seen that. Yeah, Nick Nolte. Interestingly enough, Cheryl Lee as playing both Resi and Helga. Which is kind of cool. It kind of makes me want to go back and rewatch that film adaptation, which I don't know how well regarded it is. But Nolte is a very good choice for that part. I like that casting a lot.
I remember liking the movie a lot. I've seen it two or three times, and I've read the book now two or three times.
Cheryl Lee is a really good choice, too. I like the casting, at least. But, you know, I mean, I think like it's fundamentally a pretty compelling story, and it's told in a very engaging and readable way. And, I mean, that's, you know, that's enough, really, to be a good and worthwhile book. The things that I don't love about Vonnegut, I mean, I think there were three things that I felt a little bit, that just I wasn't that keen on in this, right? One of those, there's something about his writing style that it's so, like, pithy and...
Right.
The pithiness of it begins to feel smug to me after a while, right?
Sure.
It's very pithy and epigrammatic and clever and certain of its own kind of moral certitude. I guess certain of your certitude is circular, right? But like it has a kind of, there's just a little bit of a smugness that comes off it, and not nearly the level of smugness of a truly infuriating writer, but I can't help but feel, I mean, it helps that his heart is in the right place, right? But his heart is always in the right place about like relatively straightforward positions, like war is bad, you know,
right.
Nazism is bad. That, okay, yeah, like war is bad, like good job, Vonnegut, you know? And I just don't, it rubs me the wrong way a bit. And that's kind of more about my own, that's probably more about me than the value, I mean, of what he's doing. I mean, I do think that like he's making like creative, morally sophisticated, maybe not sophisticated, he's making creative, morally valuable fiction that is very intelligently written in a way that is readable and accessible to most people. And that's both a good, noble thing and not really something I get off on as a reader, you know? And I think also like in this particular book, the modern day racists, right? Like the kind of the you know, the Nazi dentist and the Black Führer and all those characters.
Right.
The kind of the way that they're all like bumbling, ridiculous, incompetent fools. I don't know, man. Like there's a way, like the way that the whole kind of universe of contemporary bigotry is treated as this sort of irrelevant joke, you know, and they all feel like characters from a Charles Portis novel. History has not borne that out as a perspective,
sure.
You know,
and
that I think has aged the novel rather poorly and kind of defanged what might have been something more potent. And also, and this is maybe something we can come back to, I don't know what your questions are, but like, it's interesting that he is such a reliable narrator and so certain that he understands who he is. Like he's, I think a lot of other novelists who are contemporaries of Vonnegut would have played a lot more with ambiguity about what were his intentions, what were his feelings, what were his, what is the rightness or wrongness of what he did. Was he actually a spy, right? Like, but I think a lot of other novelists would have written this with both more moral and narrative ambiguity. And, you know, maybe like the fact that he is so certain about both, you know, right and wrong and what he did and why, maybe that's thematically important. You can't really have the same book without that. But I probably would have been more interested in reading a more ambiguous version of this, even though the kind of simple certainty of it is pretty key to how I think of Vonnegut.
That's interesting. Simply because it's interesting to me because it seems to me that Campbell doesn't, it seems like Campbell doesn't actually have a moral center. Like it other than I like the idea of being a hero.
Well, he says on a few different occasions that he doesn't lie to himself, right? Mm-hmm. I've always known what I did. He says that, and I think that he presents himself, and I don't know, I highlighted the phrase, I've always known what I did. I've always been able to live with what I did. How? Through that simple and widespread boon to modern mankind, schizophrenia. So, I mean, he is confessing to being, schizophrenic in a kind of metaphorical sense, right? In the sense that he is containing multitudes, but
he's in it, but
he's doing so consciously and in a very honest way. I always know when I tell a lie. I am capable of imagining the cruel consequences of anybody's believing my lies. I know cruelty is wrong. I could no more lie without noticing it than I could unknowingly pass a kidney stone.
Yeah, he's in a schizophrenic situation, right? He's being put in a context in which he has to be two-faced, right? And it is remarkable. I didn't think about this, though. I agree, Hans, because I would not consider him an unreliable narrator because he is not, he's reliable about his sort of sense of self and who he is in the moment that he's writing the memoir. Like mm-hmm. there's no gaps between, what he sees and what is while he's writing the memoir. There's a lot of certainty in the memoir, even if there's uncertainty in the story that he's telling, because of the the situation that he was in.
And his version of events is redeemed at the very end, right? A lot of other novelists, I think, would have written this in such a way that you leave it wondering if the whole idea of being an American spy was a delusion or a lie or sure enough, a letter shows up at the end and nope, he was definitely an American spy. Everything he says is literally true. And I guess to probably, for most people, that's not an unreasonable thing to have, right? There's a kind of a simplicity to style and form and theme here that, I don't know, just ultimately isn't my thing. And it might be that I'm underrating it in saying that. I'm open to that,
I really like this novel, but I also really like Ishiguro. And some of the things that we're talking about remind me of the Ishiguro conversation where and it also reminds me, and forgive me for this, I hope this makes sense. My dad had a lot of motorcycles when I was growing up, and he had some full fairing, street bikes, and he had a Triumph Daytona, which is a 1000cc kind of cruiser, full frame bike, and then he got a Honda RC51. And the Honda RC51 was a holy shit motherfucker of a bike, like kind of terrifyingly crazy fast and nimble, and was a full on race bike, but sort of detuned for the street. And he loved it and knew objectively that it was a better bike than the Daytona. But he ended up selling the RC51 because it was so far beyond his capabilities of a rider that he was only tapping into, the first, few percent of it. And he almost, it was a partly guilty, for being someone who, he didn't feel like he had the skills for a bike like that, not because he was not putting himself in danger, because he was putting himself in danger, but because he wasn't, because he, that bike, it really demands, it's there to do something else. And I think about that with, like, you know, maybe tiers of writers and the kind of ambiguity that you're talking about, Hans, and like the work that a book like this is doing, where like this is a very, very, like, it's very slight. It's very to the point. It's very sharp, and it has very little fat. And it's really good. And it has a kind of a really simple, almost moral, I would say, in it, that that I think is effective for, you know, the broad audience of readers who are not, you know, looking to be confused by they're reading. And I think that, like, you know, there's literary figures who are writing to the masses, and there are literary figures who are writing to literary audiences, and Vonnegut and Ishiguro kind of straddle both of those, so that they they appear in both camps a little bit, and so they you know, maybe they get dinged a little bit for being a little bit too pithy, being a little bit too like simple in how they wrap everything up and in the meaning that you're supposed to derive from them. But that's what most readers are capable of. So, like, you know, but I liked it. I think that, like, I hadn't read Vonnegut in many, many years. And what I really latched onto was that I felt, I didn't really, feel like I wanted, that ambiguity of whether he or not he was a spy. What I wanted was more ambiguity in and more searching and uncertainty in whether what he did had any value. And and that, because I really loved, my favorite parts of the novel were him speaking with his what is his name?
Wartanen, the operative.
Wartanen, yeah, the operative, his operative. And the operative's perspectives on the operative and Kraft, especially knowing Kraft is a spy, which were told early on, I believe. The kind of way in which they navigate this schizophrenic world, Kraft especially, just kind of like, kind of pitilessly, like, two-faced. And kind of juxtaposed against the narrator and the narrator's discomfort with this, and there's a little bit of, like, I don't know, like, he doesn't have, you know, you suggested, Patrick, that he didn't really have a moral center. There's something in him that's capable of functioning beautifully in that space, in that sort of confused context, but then he can't actually live with that, or he doesn't like that about himself, and that differentiating him from the, you know, some of the other people in that world and some of the other, you know, spycraft folks, and whether any of it really meant anything at all. And I think that those are kind of things that, like, you know, there's a version of this book that's very PKD, you know, very paranoid, you know, very like things, you know, you could do PKD or you could do John Le Carre. Like, he thinks he was a spy, but actually, like, he was working for, you know, an agency who was working for an agency who was actually, like, working for the Soviet Union. Or, you know, PKD would be, you know, like, all of his, you know, everything that he was, you know, reporting got filed in a file cabinet and never got used, or something like that. And none of, I don't know, there's a way in which I don't often think this about novels, but this was, like, too short. Like, it was too unshaggy. It was too pointed and simple for such a really great premise and a really great, like, the idea and the edifice on which this is constructed is so solid and interesting and compelling that I did want more.
You could also imagine, for instance, a Nabokov version where he's absolutely kind of, I think if Nabokov wrote this, there would be an, it would be an inverse where he would be completely certain of his goodness and his innocence and protesting those things enthusiastically. And over the course of the novel, we would come to see through that edifice and understand that he actually was a rotten person in ways he was completely in denial about, right?
Or someone who someone who knew that the Nazis were going to lose, but really was like a Nazi, like someone who, you know, like who played both parts because he wanted to save himself, or, you know, or I don't know. Like, yeah.
And I should, I mean, Patrick, I know you were about to take it back over, but I don't hate this novel, right? Like, I think it's very well constructed and entertaining and readable and, you know, morally serious. And it, I don't think it's at all bad, right? It's just not really my kind of thing and doesn't necessarily, you know, you used the word looking to be confused, Chris, right? And maybe it's ridiculous to go into books looking to be confused, but I think on some level that is kind of a value of mine, you know?
What kind of sadist, you know, not sadist, masochist wants that? I don't get that.
Right. And I think with a lot of the novels that I get really slobbery about on this show, right? A lot of the novels where like I swab their knobs, It's a lot of the time it's things that generate a great deal of confusion. They generate like at some point in the novel, you experience 100% confusion, and with effort and thought, you can resolve that into 60% clarity. Right. And that is an experience I really enjoy. That's kind of like the ultimate Hans novel experience. And this is like very, very minimal on confusion and very great on clarity, unless I am misreading it, which I'm totally open to that possibility.
So I was about to say that the more you guys talk about this, the more I think I disagree with both of you. Maybe not disagree, just feel like your reactions are not my reactions.
Sure.
So like the word simple has repeatedly been used here, and clarity and things like that. And I think that's strange because the question that the novel asks is not, to my mind, answered in any clear way. And I'd say the central question comes out when Campbell is talking with his father-in-law, Werner Noth, however you pronounce it. And Werner Noth says, you know, if I found out you now that you were a spy, I would not care in the slightest, because what you did as a spy, you know, even though you were a spy, whatever you did to further the Nazi cause was, you know, still great and, you know, still very, very important. And so the question is, you know, like, he's a spy, and on the one hand, he could be helping the Allies win the war, but he also could be really be furthering these racist ideas and racist causes. And we definitely know that he has furthered racist ideas and racist causes. You know, like the people who care about him, except maybe Racy, end up being, you know, white supremacists, and I don't necessarily think that the Black Führer of Harlem is a white supremacist so much as just a fascist who you know, kind of agrees with the fascist line of thinking. So I we could have gotten into more detail there, but at the same time, as we do know that all of these racist ideas have been kind of furthered by Campbell, we're less certain about what he has done as a spy, what kind of things did his spy things, what kind of positive effects did his spy stuff have? We don't really know. And that's certainly like a question. Like any if we really think about in a kind of consequentialist vein, a moral consequentialist vein, we would really have to wonder, we really have to ask, which one of these outcomes has had the greater effect? So let's say whatever he did as a spy did contribute to winning World War II. Okay. So we
And that
have to.
is, not to interrupt, but the letter from Virtanen says you were one of the most effective agents of the Second World War. So it's to the extent that that's reliable. I mean, we know very little about what his spying does, but it is confirmed
But
that he was one of the most effective agents of the Second World War.
that he was one of the most effective agents. And this is where I think like the idea that it's a simple like the like what we're supposed to take away from this is simple. That doesn't totally ring true to me because there's so much left to understand and left to know. Like, what? How are we supposed to know whether his choice was moral or not? Whether what he did end up doing, did it outweigh this kind of stuff? And I suppose the only difference, maybe the difference that we're having is that this question that we're not sure of is it's an ethical question rather than an aesthetic one, maybe.
Maybe.
Like it's clear what we're supposed to think about, even though it's not necessarily clear what the answer to the ethical question is.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
I was gonna say, I think that like it's an interesting sort of thought experiment, craft-wise, to imagine this book answering the sort of economy of pain question, right? So like did he make a choice that caused did he in his work cause more pain than he alleviated, or did he alleviate more pain than he caused? And I think that like for Hans and I, that's like less interesting, like so like that if it veers into those concrete answers or like that, then like Hans and I probably like maybe Hans especially, I'm somewhat somewhere between you two, like kind of like our eyes glaze over, or we don't trust the messenger, right? Like there's yet another version of this where the operative is insisting that like you've won the war for us, and more and more like the harder he insists, the less true it feels, right? The more that it feels like, wait, he's still engineering me. He's still, like he's trying to make me feel like I've done, my work has meant something, but how can I ever know that? And like, but I think that the issue is that like Campbell doesn't really wonder that too much. Like he's more,
And that and that's
it feels more like
that's
that he's worried. It feels more like he's conflicted on a personal level than on a like an ethical level.
right. But that's actually one reason that I said I'm not sure he has a moral center. And I retract that statement somewhat. He does have a moral center. It's just that it's romanticism. Like his own, the only thing he really cares about is love for his wife Helga, right? It really seems to be one of the very few things that he's interested in,
Well, and his her hot ass younger sister. So.
Yeah, yeah, and Racy, and that's something I find interesting too. Like he's actually a non-political person. Like he's a non-political, non-ethical person whose work, whose plays are all medieval romanticies or medieval romances. That really, really have nothing to do with like everything in his personal life is far removed from these ethical, political questions that he gets entangled in. And so I find that to be another interesting aspect of the novel where the novel asks a very central ethical question that people with my disposition find extremely interesting and not very simple at all, because the answer is not straightforward. The answer is like we would really have to dig more and more into the nitty gritty of the outcomes to understand what the actual answer is. And then so we've got this really nitty gritty ethical question alongside a character who has no, like, has really a non-political center, a non-political personal identity. And that to me is very interesting and very crazy. So it's hard to, it seems very profound to me is what I will say. Like to someone with my disposition, the novel feels very profound and very, very dense in that it's, like you said, Chris, it's not shaggy, doesn't have any extra fat, but dense because it's got all of this under the surface, all of these deep questions packed into this little space. So
I'll tell you, just this one line. Sorry.
No,
that's fine. Like for me was like where the denseness, like I wanted that denseness to open up into like a space where like even more would be, I think, and it's the operative talking to Campbell and telling him about Racy and Joe and
Craft,
yeah, I was going to say Clark. But he says, generally speaking, espionage offers each spy an opportunity to go crazy in a way that he finds irresistible. And mm-hmm. I fucking love that line. Like, that's like such a cool idea. And that's why, like, I don't necessarily personally need him to, I didn't necessarily need the question to be whether or not he was a spy, because I felt like that in and of itself was so interesting, and yet he's not crazy. Like he doesn't feel crazy at all to me.
Right.
And he feels extraordinarily conflicted and trapped, but I wish he was crazier. Sorry, I interrupted.
Well, and
no, that's all right.
You said, Chris, a little while ago, you brought up the question of whether he alleviates more suffering than he causes or causes more suffering than he alleviates, right? And I do think that the answer to that is in the text, because the contemporary people who are inspired by his ideas are ineffectual buffoons, right? I mentioned earlier that the buffoonishness of the contemporary racists, for lack of a
even the Nazis
are
buffoons.
Well, the Nazis are buffoons, but they're buffoons in the context of knowing, you know, what World War II was, right? Whereas, like, the contemporary racists, you just don't get any sense that at least I did not, maybe I'm underestimating it, but you don't get any sense that to the extent that his ideas and words still resonate with people, they're a tiny minority of ineffectual buffoons, right? And so on the one hand, in the positive column, you have some of the most effective agenting of World War II. And in the negatives, you have residually inspiring by accident a small number of ineffectual buffoons. So it does seem to me that from a consequentialist standpoint, the novel actually I think, has enough internal evidence for us to, at the very end of it at least, determine that he's actually consequentially done a lot more good than bad. However, you know, and it might be that, like, you could, that there's a, the way that he responds to that is to kill himself, and that is interesting, right? Rather than take the opportunity to be affirmed as a hero, he instead, once he is given the affirmation that he has been a good person, he realizes that the kind of external consequential version of goodness has not satisfied the kind of conflict of his soul and kills himself. And that is interesting. I'll actually admit that that is an interesting, I don't want to underestimate that, right? Like, that is intriguing. At the same time, like, not, again, not to play the, like, different version of this, right? But, like, Chris, you said that you wanted this to be a longer novel. And you said, like, what if Philip K. Dick wrote it? I think if Philip K. Dick wrote it, there would be a contemporary Donald Trumpish figure who was actually in danger of gaining real power, who in some way was drawing on the inspiration of his work. And I think that if you had that, if you had something like that, where it we really had continued doubts about whether or not maybe, like, he had truly done bad in the world in the course of trying to, you know, be a good spy, you know, maybe that would, then you wouldn't have the kind of, what I just said was interesting. You wouldn't have that. I just, from the aesthetics of what I'm drawn to as a reader, I think I would find that more intriguing. And it would also, I don't know, there was just, I keep coming back to, like, how buffoonish those neo-Nazi characters are. And it did a great deal, I think, that one fact, I think, undermined a lot of the kind of seriousness and what might have been more seriousness and complexity in the book, even though, like, I also understand, like, the where that impulse comes from, you know.
Can I speak to that buffoonishness for a second? So I agree that the white supremacist or racist or fascist characters are buffoons, but the effect that had for me was to actually found them more empathetic, because they, you know, I understood right away, oh, these guys are buffoons, their horrible ideas and their racism are not effective, they're stupid idiots who, you know, are unable to really find any, like, any way of seeing self-actualization in this world that they live in. And so what that did for me was, like, oh, these people are tragic dopes, you know. And I actually think that's where the, like, the real question about the harm that Campbell has caused comes into play. Because there are several moments where you get, like, a snippet of Campbell thinking about, or Reverend Dr. Jones talking about some quote-unquote good person, good white American who is just trying to make it in the world, or, you know, something like that, who has really... What's happened is that these people have been bamboozled, right? They have been bamboozled by a system that doesn't care about them into blaming the other, into black people or Jews or whatever. And Campbell's spy persona, or not spy persona, Campbell's Nazi persona has given an outlet to these people and allowed them to channel their reasonable rage at living in a world where they aren't self-actualized, and they end up, you know, channeling that into, you know, hating other people, which is stupid and horrifying. But that was something that I found to be very poetic, right? So we've got these people who might actually be decent. Like, it's crazy because, like, when you see, like, Dr. Jones, and when you the first time you see Dr. Jones, he's with his retinue, and one Father Keeley, this old guy, walks up these stairs to Campbell's house, and then he has a heart attack or something, and it's like, oh God, their friend is dying, you know? And you can see that these people have normal human empathy, and yet because of people like Campbell, their normal human empathy has been skewed and fucked up, right? So that I found to be very, very kind of like this very strange and very, very poetic, very profound, like, way of kind of tilting this utilitarian calculus that we've been talking about. So again, I'm just not quite convinced of your position, Hans. Go on.
I like the idea of that as you describe it. I like that a lot. Mm. I went back and reread the biography of the dentist, and I don't know if I get that sense, right? Like, I don't get the sense, like, he's a competent dentist, and they hope that he will, you know, they initially ignore his racist ravings in the hope that he can develop as a competent dentist and have a good career. And I mean, I guess, like, you can, you know, you can envision a version of that character where, like, oh, my dad was a dentist, my grandfather was a dentist, they want me to be a dentist, I want to find more meaning in the world. But it, I mean, I don't get that sense from the character. I don't get the sense that he's, like, mad at capitalism or not appropriately self-actualized, or he's just a good dentist. He's a you know, a middle-class person from a good background with talent who, it sounds like, has paranoid schizophrenia and manifests those with a particular set of stupid ideas. And I mean, I guess it's bad that, you know, like, you, it's if there are going to be paranoid schizophrenics in the world, it's bad that there are racist ideas out there for them to fixate on, but they're going to fixate on something destructive, right? It's in the nature of the illness. And so I appreciate how you've described that, but I can't go back and make myself feel that about the actual book that I read, you know, as much as I like that thought of it, you know?
Well, I do agree that maybe the dentist is not the best candidate for that description. But I think that there probably are, like, so it's not so much the dentist or the specific characters that are mentioned as it is, like, people in general that Campbell and the dentist and his retinue talk about. Like, they discuss good Americans who, who have bought into, like, Campbell's line of Nazi propaganda when they really shouldn't have been buying into it, obviously. So, I don't know. There's probably not any common ground here. The more I think about it, the more I think, I don't think that, like, so, like, you guys have been talking about, like, other versions of this novel, and I just want, in my head, I'm just like, ugh, like, all these other versions, whatever. I don't, like, you know.
Yeah, like, that's fair.
You know, PKD would do his thing, and, like, there are novels by PKD that I absolutely love, but I also find it very stressful when PKD won't just, like, you know, it's okay to think about a real ethical problem instead of, you know, being paranoid.
Right.
You know, like, that's okay. That's okay. We don't, you know, comparing PKD to well, Ted Chiang, right? Like, I remember talking about Ted Chiang, and we're like, well, if PKD had written these stories, he wouldn't have done anything that Chiang did. I'm like, true. And what Chiang did was
necessarily a fair critique.
Like, what Chiang did sometimes is pretty cool. Like, when he was, like, I think the story I liked most about Chiang was his Middle Eastern or Arabian, like, deterministic gate story, like time travel through these gates, and the main character is like a Muslim flunky merchant or something like that, and like he really thought about the idea of a determined life in a way that I found very satisfying. And in a way that PKD would not have done. And that's fine. Like, PKD is going to do his thing. Ted Chiang's going to do his thing. And I definitely think that there are things to dislike about Vonnegut. In fact, a lot of my questions, a lot of the questions that I kind of came up with, like, to talk about, which we haven't really talked about, but that doesn't matter. Brought up some ideas, some things that Vonnegut does that I don't really like. So he has a tendency for characters to kind of morph in the novel, like, into a totally different character. So in Sirens of Titan, we start with a guy named it's like Michael or something like that, but then he gets kidnapped and taken to Titan, where he's brainwashed, and like the earlier character who was like a third of, who we followed through a third of the way through the novel and who was the protagonist, is gone. Now it's just this kind of brainwashed idiot named Unk, right? And he does something similar to another character in his novel Galapagos. So that's kind of a trope I dislike. I also dislike the pithiness sometimes. In this novel, it seemed to come out in him talking, like, him mentioning full names and titles of characters all the time. So the Reverend Dr. D.D.S. Jones, or Howard W. Campbell Jr., or Robert Sterling Wilson, the Black Fur of Harlem. So there's definitely things that I agree with, like this, that Vonnegut does that are irritating, but kind of, I would say that, like, putting forward an ethical question and making us think about that ethical question is probably not something that I'm going to find off-putting. And it's not something that I'm going to, like, be like, man, I wish PKD had done this novel instead, you know?
Well, and there are probably two mea culpas I should offer, right, in relationship to that. I do think that the the kind of critical trope of evaluating a novel in relationship to what you wish it was rather than trying to appreciate it on its own terms. Like, I understand that can be maddening, right? And it's hard to avoid sometimes, but it is, you know, it's unfair. Like, clearly Vonnegut was not trying to write a Nabokovian book in which the protagonist gradually reveals himself to be an irredeemable sociopath, right? That's so, you know, evaluating it as a failure for not doing that thing is nonsensical. I mean, I didn't say it was a failure, but I implied I would rather have read that, which is probably true, but not necessarily fair to what he's trying to do, right? Obviously, Nabokov and PKD are even though you could kind of spin them in a surface way as being, as doing similar things, they're in fact radically different writers. And, you know, like being mad at Vonnegut for not being PKD is, again, probably not a fair evaluation of how Vonnegut achieves what he's trying to do. And I do think that, like, what Vonnegut is trying to do, he generally does very well according to, like, what seem to be the goals of the work, right? And the other thing I would say is, I probably, to some extent, having thought about, having heard how you kind of outlined the philosophical and moral questions of the novel, I was probably somewhat guilty of mistaking aesthetic straightforwardness for thematic straightforwardness. And that's, you know, that's, I think that's a fair critique. And there are ways in which it probably is actually a more thematically complex book than I had initially given it credit for, to some extent because of, you know, the fatlessness, Chris, that you point to, the pithiness that we talked about, the ways in which that pithiness can come off as smugness. Like those, probably I think to some extent, like my, having thought about it at more length with you, I probably did underrate it in that regard. I don't feel that drawn to read more Vonnegut because I do still, I just don't take a lot of joy in experiencing his style, basically, right? But I don't think he's like disreputable as a writer. You know, if somebody said they loved Vonnegut, I would not look down on them in the way that I would look down on someone who said they loved James Patterson, you know?
Right. I actually picked this novel because I think it's actually an outlier for Vonnegut. As far as I know, this is not on the list of one of his most beloved novels. Like, I think that goes to like Cat's Cradle and Slaughterhouse Five.
Breakfast of Champions.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I don't think this is the one. Like, I actually think as far as, this is actually less Vonnegut-y than a lot of his other work is. And I several years ago, I decided to pick up a Vonnegut novel. The first one I read, I think, was Slaughterhouse Five, and I thought it was all right. Then I think I read Cat's Cradle, and I thought, oh, this is all right. Then I read this and I was like, oh, this is like, I really dig this one. Like, I think this one is cool. And then I read Sirens of Titan. I thought, well, I that one was kind of cool. And then I read Galapagos and I was like, this sucks. And I haven't read a Vonnegut since I read Galapagos. And that was like 10 years ago. So I don't want to, like, when I defend this book, it's I generally think that it is thematically complex and thematically interesting. I can totally understand why you would not like this novel from like the pithiness perspective and the smugness or whatever. I totally get that. But to defend this novel isn't to defend Vonnegut entirely. I to my mind, I do think maybe he is overrated, like you said last time, Hans. I think maybe he is really overrated, and I think that, like, I don't, like, not, the other novels I've read by him never felt this deep or poetic to me. Like, I feel like this novel has a sense of tragedy and thematic depth that his other novels don't. And that's why I chose it.
I think that's totally fair.
I think I would rank this above the others. And I've read Cat's Cradle, Slaughterhouse Five, Breakfast of Champions. I might have read another one when I was really young, and I'm blanking on it now. I really liked Breakfast of Champions when I was a kid because it has a drawing of an anus in it. That was big on my, that made me very happy.
Sure.
But, I was moved by this novel. I think that I really liked it. You know, I And it is not fair to
PKD.
Well, no, I wish. So I'll say within the aesthetics and themes of the novel itself, like not like wishing that someone else had written it. I wish that the confrontation between O'Hare and Campbell wasn't there for Campbell to make such a bald statement.
I actually agree with that.
That felt kind of Hallmarky dopey.
I did not like that. I didn't remember it. Like I read this a while back, and then I re-listened to it for the podcast. And I was like, oh, I don't like this. Like, you know, don't hate anybody that you don't know. Come on now. Like you have not been a stand-up guy this whole time. Like, you have been a weird, creepy, you know, kind of, you know, non-political dude this whole time. So you can stop with this BS. That was my feeling.
Yeah.
I think the confrontation is okay, but if you just eliminate the speech that he has, it the novel gets better. I agree with that.
I think that's the where you feel like Vonnegut is putting his thumb on the scale of the story a little bit to kind of get that voiced, because that feels to like a kind of a point that he wants to make. Right. And that I would cut that, you know, like basically editor, you know, we don't need this. It's clear enough. Like, it's better to be, it's more interesting for him to be lost in uncertainty than to know a kind of moral thing, have a clear moral stand. That's, I guess, the confusing part. Like, you're confused about whether he has a moral center or not. He knows a moral center. He has an idea of what it is. He doesn't think he has it. And it's just not that interesting. As interesting as him being like confused.
I 100% agree with that.
I have a question about how something landed with the two of you.
Okay.
I, just as a preface, I'll preface this. I am married. If my wife died, and 16 years later, her younger sister came to me and said, I am Loan, and she has a younger sister, right? If Brinny were to come to me in 16 years and say, no, I'm Loan, I would say, absolutely fucking not, you are Brinny. The whole plot line of like, I'm your wife. Oh, actually, I'm the sister. Did that feel plausible to you? That just felt like notably implausible to me. Am I the only one who had that reaction? And I mean, I guess I don't know. Like, maybe I'm not being empathetic enough. Like, 16 years is a long time. He probably doesn't have any photos of Helga. In some ways, it's more interesting if it is implausible, because maybe he, on some level, wants to believe and is fooling himself. Or am I overcomplicating a simple thing?
My reaction was that it's like, given his innate sense of romanticism, his kind of, what's that? There's a cool word for, loving your wife too much. And it's in The English Patient, but I forget the name of it, the word, but you know, he's got an innate sense of romanticism. He, like, the love for his wife, which is his central, like, character trait, is not overdone aesthetically. Like, I think it's purposely, like, his like main thing, right? So given his personal neuroses, I thought it was believable. Especially, you know, like, assuming he is thinking about his wife all the time, he probably doesn't even think about Resi. Like, it doesn't seem like they were very close. He was very close to his in-laws before the war, right? So
that's true. And I guess like he didn't know Resi as an adult, right? Like it's one thing you know, like somebody's going to change a lot less from 10 to somebody's going to change a lot more from 10 to 26 than from, you know, 30 to 46.
Right. So assuming that we can believe that sisters sometimes look a shit ton alike, which they sometimes do, I think it's buyable. You can buy it.
Okay.
Yeah, it didn't break.
That was my response.
It didn't break verisimilitude for me, or whatever. You know, suspension of disbelief, whatever.
Yeah, verisimilitude. Okay, so we spent a lot of time kind of voicing our different reactions to the novel, and I think it was profitable. Like, you know, I don't think this is the greatest novel ever, but I did like it. I did, like, I do, like, confusion is just not a response to a novel that I'm very interested in at all. And I wonder if this will make sense to you too. So this is a response I typically have. If a novel reveals a truth to me that I already knew, I typically am like, oh, cool, this person understands as well. I like that this person has put to words something that I already knew and understood. Like, I like that experience. And I wonder if you guys think that is, like, condescending. Does that make sense? Like, if a writer says something that you know to be true already, do you find that irritating, or you feel like this isn't something that you need to tell me? I'm not an idiot. Is that your reaction?
I think that if it's a nonfiction work, so I think for when it comes to novels, I'm not looking to kind of like have my worldview. I mean, I think we're all looking to have our worldviews affirmed. I'm not a fucking saint,
sure,
you know, but like, sure. But sure. But specifically, like, the pleasure of wonder that I get from being like, feeling like I'm drifting anchor, feeling like I don't know where I am, feeling like I've lost reference points that I've didn't know that I relied upon. I love that feeling. Like I crave it. And so,
you crave it
for sure. Absolutely. Sure. For sure. Okay. Like and so like for me, I don't go into a novel. No, that's not true. I mean, I read like science fiction, you know, adventure shit, you know, and but like that's like a different thing. If I'm reading something that's like that's aspiring to like a literary, like, and again, I think that's a problematic, you know, distinction. But if it's aspiring to, you know, break my brain open rather than just to entertain me, like I want it to break my brain open in a way that like I don't know exactly all of what it means, if that makes sense. Like I crave that from books.
Sure.
I think that that feeling of something that you already thought or believed putting into words, I find that satisfying in songs and poems and essays. It's not the only thing that I find satisfying in songs and poems and essays, but it's a thing they can do that I sometimes find it satisfying when they do. It's one of many things those media can do. I don't know that I look for it in fiction so much, you know? I think like that there are just, I mean, there are a lot of things that I find interesting and satisfying in fiction. Probably one of the core ones is that sense of adriftness that you talked about, Keith. Chris, rather. I have a good friend named
Keith.
Keith is a guy that I work with who is one of my best friends, a person I'm very fond of.
Hear that, Keith? He said, fuck you.
I think Keith's only ever listened to one episode of the show, but.
Oh, sure.
And only because I put it on YouTube, but. But yeah, I mean, there's just a lot. For whatever reason, like that particular sensation isn't something I find as interesting in fiction as I think I like a push and pull between confusion and understanding. And I like it when that push and pull resolves somewhat in favor of confusion. And I like coming out of something and knowing that I got some of it, but not all of it. And there's more there to come back for on a second or third or fourth read. And there are things that, like, I don't know, like we talked about Stalker on an unpublished podcast because I was a dumbass and tried to record it in a fairgrounds during a car show. And
just like I fucked up the last podcast because I was like, oh yeah, my chanting, singing daughter can sit in the room with me. Sure.
Yeah,
I am sorry about that, guys. I feel so stupid.
Think that, like, as a question of batting average, I still think like the most lost episodes have been thanks to my bad decisions. But
I don't know. I haven't been keeping score or anything.
Yeah, but I know I'm not keeping score. But I mean, I think that like we talked about Stalker, right? And Stalker is something that. Yeah, I've seen that movie probably four or five times, and for most of the first few times that I watched it, I thought of it as a very ambiguous, strange, inscrutable text. And after about the fourth time, I think, like, if I remember right, I think I had actually a pretty clear and pinned down sense of what it meant and what it was trying to say. And I find that much more pleasurable and interesting than. Something where you come out the first time and you're like, yep, got it. If anything, if I have any issue, it's that I wish that it were still more ambiguous, right? I wish it was something like, I don't know, The Master, where it's like, I still don't know the fuck that movie's trying to say, and I've seen that five times, right? Like, but I don't know, I guess like, that's a very particular personal thing, though, you know, and it's very easy. I think sometimes it's easy to mistake, you know, if you're I probably am personally prone to being charmed by style in ways which spur me to mistake vagueness for profundity and nonsense for enigma, and I'll cop to that.
Sure,
you pig fuck. Great movie.
Stalker?
No, The Master.
Oh, I haven't seen it. Is that?
Oh, it's so good.
With Philip Seymour Hoffman?
Yeah. Yep.
P.T. Anderson. Yeah, that's like the best movie. If somebody held a gun to my head and was just like, immediately tell me the best movie, I'd be like, The Master. I might
so
have
good.
A different answer once I thought about it, but that would be like my gut check.
Oh, man.
That's just it.
If somebody held a gun to my head and said, what's the best movie? What do I say? Like,
well, I'll get a gun and I'll go to Cincinnati and we'll figure this out for real.
Guys, I have to.
No, I guess I got the order wrong. First, I'm going to go to Cincinnati. Then I'm going to get a gun because then we'll let me take it on the plane.
Yeah.
I have to get moving.
All right. Tell us your pick real quick.
Yeah. So I heard what you said about not wanting confusion, and
I didn't say that. Actually, no, I did. I explicitly said that.
So
confusion is dumb.
I was thinking we could do Lynch. David Lynch, a combination of Catching the Big Fish, which is not the book I have. I have his other one, Room to Dream. But I do kind of wonder, that's a longer book. And I want to put some movies in here too, if you guys are are comfortable, I was thinking we could do Catching the Big Fish, which is a short book. I think it's like not even 200 pages. And three of his movies? Is that too much?
I could do that. Might be more harder for Patrick.
No, I mean,
two. We could do two. So I was going to do three because just
I've
to kind of.
I've probably seen them all anyway.
Yeah, it's going to span his oeuvre a little bit. So like Eraserhead.
Seen it.
Lost Highway.
Seen it.
And.
Motherfucking Inland Empire. Say it.
Inland Empire is so long.
But it is long, but it's crazy interesting.
All right, we can do Inland Empire. That really does span his you know whole filmography. So does that feel okay to you guys? It's quite a bit of movie.
Watch those movies and read that book by David Lynch.
Yeah, I think that book is really short.
Okay.
The other book All is right. long.
Sounds good to me. Like I've for a long time I've thought about like wouldn't it be fun to like just do some movies, you know? To like there's no sure. reason we couldn't. Like most of the like I know we're all literature educated, but a lot of that stuff transfers.
For sure.
Oh yeah.
Thinking about films is transfers between literature. So
Hans, yeah. you are the Lynch expert. Did those three movies make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if I'm the Lynch expert, but I 100%. Yeah, I mean, first and last, right? The middle one, there's some room to argue, but Lost Highway, I think, is probably maybe the most challenging of his middle period yes. movies. So
yeah, that's kind of why I went to it, because really the first and last movies are very challenging. So I didn't want to put. Any of his other
You didn't want to put the
there.
Straight story in the middle and then it doesn't
No,
make sense.
I didn't.
Okay, listeners, thanks for tuning in.